and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Attorney General Jeff Sessions' recusal he announced today from investigations into Russian involvement in the election, following news reports from the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal that appear to have caught him in a lie during his confirmation testimony before the Senate. Ed Kilgore, a political columnist for the New York Magazine, joins us to discuss his latest article at New York Magazine, Sessions Executes Strategic Retreat on Recusal but Leaves Some Big Questions Unanswered. We'll discuss the questions that loom over the country's top law enforcement official, who has many Democratic political leaders and some Republicans calling for his resignation or for a special prosecutor to investigate possible ties to Trump and the Russians. Then we'll speak with John Nichols, The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent and co-author of People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. He joins us to discuss his article at The Nation, If Jeff Sessions Will Not Resign, He Should Be Impeached, and the extent to which the failing New York Times, as Trump calls it, is leading a comeback for print journalism with its investigative reporting on Trump that is causing the paper's subscriptions to soar, and the growing possibility that Sessions could be impeached. Then finally, we will examine the failure of the Democratic Party to offer an effective response to Donald Trump's successful address to Congress, and contrast former Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear's folksy rebuttal to the powerful takedown that Bernie Sanders offered up in a point-by-point list of the critical issues facing the nation and the world that Trump did not mention. Investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus joins us to discuss the Populist.buzz, a new online news platform he has co-founded that is devoted to reporting on and analyzing post-2016 efforts to rethink and rebuild the Democratic Party. And joining us now is Ed Kilgore, a political columnist for New York Magazine, the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and his latest article at New York Magazine is Sessions Executes Strategic Retreat into Recusal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Kilgore.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
Let's talk a little bit about, obviously, Sessions is the story of the day, but let's talk a little bit about the Democratic response to President Trump's State of the Union. Of course, he got very good reviews pretty much across the board, and people thought that he was presidential for a change, and I don't know what it's done in terms of his poll numbers. But in contrast, there was a lot of discomfort about the Democratic response, the rebuttal from the former Kentucky governor. Who made that decision? Was that Donna Brazile's last decision or Tom Perez's first decision?
Well, those are usually made by consensus among Democratic leaders, so she may have pulled the trigger, but I suspect others had input. Interestingly, I wrote a piece last week sort of challenging that choice, and just about everybody I knew told me I was wrong. And the reason was pretty simple. Nobody knew what Trump was going to say or do. And the one thing Democrats knew they had to do was defend Obamacare. So, and Beshear was uniquely equipped to do that as a governor of a state who implemented the Affordable Care Act fully and had a lot of success. So, and the real problem, though, is that Trump wrong-footed everybody. These responses have to be taped in advance before anybody's heard the speech or seen it. And, you know, there were issues with the delivery, too, in the background and a lot of the production factors. But, you know, going with if they had gotten a stem-winding anti-Trump speaker, that might have provided a even worse contrast, since Trump was being so sunny and upbeat, if not always very honest.
So is there a possibility that Trump will stay presidential and stay on message and somehow restrain his lack of impulse control?
I wouldn't bet the farm on it. certainly not. And it's interesting, it's a little early, but the initial indications are, even though the public, those who watched the speech, liked it, he isn't getting much any bump in approval ratings so far. They're basically flat. So, and, you know, by and large, people forget about these speeches pretty quickly. So I think if he's going to maintain this sort of, you know, exceeding this low bar by appearing something other than erratic, he's going to have to keep doing it if it's going to have any effect on his image, it appears. And so whether he can do that, that's anybody's guess.
Well, Ed, since you were a former federal states relations staffer for three governors of Georgia, what do you think is going to happen with that seat that Tom Price vacated? I take it that the Democrats are going to make a big play for it, and it would be a big boost, wouldn't it, if they took that seat?
Yes, it would. And there, you know, there's a 30-year-old candidate named John Ossoff, first-time candidate, who's done phenomenally well in fundraising. He has reportedly raised over $2 million, which is a whole lot of money for Georgia. And there's a field of, I believe, 17 candidates. And all what he really needs to do initially is just to make a runoff. And there's several fairly credible Republicans running, too. So, you know, I think it'll be after the first round on April 18th when we'll know what this is really going to look like. You know, given the circumstances, this is a Republican-leaning district. More importantly, this is a special election. And Democrats everywhere, particularly in Georgia, have a very poor record of turning out for special elections. But if they do, and they somehow win this seat, which I would consider a possibility, it will really be significant, because as I said when I first wrote about this, this should be a race that's the Republicans to lose. They may find a way to do that thanks to Donald Trump.
Well, there's a lot of activism out there that's happening with or without the Democratic Party. It seems to be these couple of young staffers with Indivisible have done more work to get people out than just about anybody.
Well, yeah, they've done a great job. But I would point to the special election this last weekend in Delaware, state Senate election, which actually was for control of the state Senate, which was otherwise tied. And Democrats had quite a good combination of national resources and local messaging, and won that what was expected to be a very close race decisively. That was a very good sign for Democrats.
And it didn't hurt to have the former vice president campaigning, right?
No, though I don't know that he was a central figure in it, but no, it didn't hurt.
Right.
But again, he's a national figure who's obviously very well known in Delaware, too.
And again, I'm speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's a political columnist for the New York Magazine, the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist and online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn. And his latest article at New York Magazine is Sessions Executes Strategic Retreat into Recusal, but Leaves Some Big Questions Unanswered. So, he has, of course, today, Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself from Russian investigations, but
involving the campaign.
Right, involving the presidential campaign as well
not,
as any.
Possibly not those that involve contacts after the election. He might recuse himself from those, too, but he hasn't promised to.
Right. But he's also recusing himself from any inquiries into ties between Donald Trump's campaign and Russian officials. Now, he was a member of Donald Trump's campaign, an early member. And my understanding is that he ran their national security team and that he recruited Carter Page, who's at the guy that's front and center in all of this. What's your understanding on that?
I don't think anybody was more important to Donald Trump personally than Jeff Sessions. Nobody. He was his first and for a long time his only supporter anywhere in Congress, House or Senate. You know, he very much pioneered much of Trump's message, particularly on immigration, but also on law and order and some other topics. And yes, you're right. His chief staffer, Stephen Miller, is now one of the most important people in the country in the White House. So there's no question he wasn't simply a Trump surrogate. He was close to the heartbeat of the whole campaign.
And Stephen Miller, he was his number one aide, was he not?
I can't remember whether he was chief of staff or legislative director, but he was definitely a big deal.
Right.
He used to work for Michelle Bachmann, by the way, which ought to terrify everybody.
Well, you know, when he was at Santa Monica High out here in Los Angeles, a lot of people were saying he went to SAMO High. And they all had to do a kind of a videotape presentation of their debating skills. And guess what subject Miller chose for his, you know, in this very progressive place. His presentation was an attack on Sam O'Hai's janitors for not working hard enough and not picking up trash. In other words,
he
went after the working stiffs. I mean, what makes these guys tick? It's pretty amazing, isn't it? So, anyway, let's talk a little bit about the possibilities here. Do you think the Democrats are going to handed a gift with this Russian thing? I mean, the New York Times, of course, has reported towards the end, the Obama administration put a lot of this material out in such a way that it was still classified, but at least it was distributed around sufficiently that it would be more difficult for the Trump people to suppress it. And you have to admit that Trump has a firewall. He's got his political guy at the CIA. He's got his political guy at the DNI, well, soon to be there, Coates. He's got his people from his campaign at both the House and Senate committees, both Senator Burr and Congressman Nunes, both of whom have effectively been shilling for Trump. But the biggest part of his firewall is Jeff Sessions. Has he lost that chink in his armor?
Well, I don't know about that, but Sessions is obviously going to have to be very careful. I think what's interesting about the Sessions case is, once again, it shows that every time you think there might not be anything to this Russian stuff, people around Trump behave as though there might be. To me, it's kind of astonishing that Jeff Sessions, in his confirmation hearing, when asked directly about contacts between the Trump campaign and any kind of Russians, conveniently forgot to mention his two meetings with the ambassador from Russia, one of them fairly extensive. That really strains credulity that he wouldn't consider it relevant enough to mention. And he even sort of admitted that today in his press conference, that he should have mentioned it. And, you know, and again, the idea that people wanting to meet with Jeff Sessions in 2016 were careful to distinguish between his role as a U.S. senator and his role as a Trump campaign official, that strains credulity, too. Everybody knew how important he was to Donald Trump. So, again, if there's no there, why do the people around Trump keep acting so strangely about it all? That's what I'd like to know.
Right. And the other question is, particularly when it pertains to Michael Flynn and his conversations with the Russian ambassador, he's a former intelligence official from Defense Intelligence Agency. He was the former head of it, as a matter of fact. You'd think that he would have known that the NSA were tapping the Russians' phones. So what is there some peculiar arrogance going on here with these characters?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, in Sessions' case, you know, he has invested so much, and other Republicans have, in his reputation as this unshakable figure of integrity who you may think he's crazy, you may not agree with him, but everybody has to admit that he's completely honest, always tells the truth, blah, blah, blah. That was an important part of the whole fight of over his confirmation. And here he is kind of acting like, you know, a shyster, like a weaselly lawyer who's splitting hairs when asked a pretty simple question about whether you met with Russians. So in other words, I guess what I'm saying here is that it looks like these folks, certainly Sessions, are willing to sacrifice things of value to them in order to hold a line on this issue. And that, again, makes you wonder what's there.
Well, particularly when it pertains to Donald Trump himself, you would think that he would want to lift this cloud of illegitimacy over his presidency.
You would think so, yeah. I don't claim to have any inside knowledge of what's going on or whether there's anything here at all. But again, there sure is an awful lot of smoke, and I don't really understand why Trump and the people around him, as you said, aren't trying to lay this to rest with something other than denial. I don't know where this is going to go next, but obviously there is an investigation underway of which Jeff Sessions will not be a part.
Right. But unfortunately, it's at the Intelligence Committee where, again, Burr and Nunes are pretty much in Trump's pocket. And that's by nature conducted in secret. So when people are calling...
Well, I don't know. Obviously, and I'm not sure this is a good thing in the long run, but obviously the intelligence community is not going to let things that it knows get buried. We've seen that pretty often on some pretty important things already. That's one reason we're even having this conversation. So I'm not very, aside from the fact that Democrats and even some Republicans are on high alert over anything to do with Russia, I really am not sure that guys like Burr and Nunez are going to be able to bury anything for very long.
Right, but basically it's all being conducted in secret, and what people are calling for, and this goes across the board: Elizabeth Warren, Nancy Pelosi, even Senator Lindsey Graham. They're calling for an open investigation, rather like the 9/11 Commission. And by the way, it's worth noting that George W. Bush resisted the 9/11 Commission being established for about a year. It took a lot of pressure from the widows of the 9/11 widows to get that to happen.
Yep, you're right.
So what will it take to get this independent commission to happen? Will it take...
Well, it obviously, I think if I were them, I would want an open investigation because they, leaks from the intelligence community directly to the news media are even harder to control than whatever might come out in an open, formal investigation. So, I don't buy this idea that they can just bury it and it'll all go away. But without knowing what's actually underneath all this, it's really hard to predict where it's going to go or how hard the Trump people might fight the kind of investigation you're talking about. We just don't know.
Well, we do know that what Donald Trump has established, at least with his core supporters, is that you can't trust the intelligence people, and least of all, you can trust the media, the fake news. So is that a strategy, do you think, Ed Kilgore, a strategy?
Well, I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, yeah, he's already kind of pre-made that case and will probably continue to do so. On the other hand, right now, he's basking in all this love from the news media, for not behaving that way. So he's got to pick at some point. Does he want this to, does he want his 35% to 40% of the electorate, hardcore base to be the only people he's talking to for the next 2 to 4 years? Will the Republican Party go along with this? And by the way, how does he deal with all this and at the same time deal with the absolute chaos in Congress over his and their agenda, which is what we would be talking about today if we weren't talking about Russians?
Well, let's just talk about in the last couple of minutes. Obviously, the Affordable Care Act is front and center in that. But what else? The infrastructure package?
Well, taxes. Uh-huh. I think the infrastructure package, congressional Republicans have decided to put it off till next year. Nothing Trump said in his speech the other night indicated an intention to do otherwise. You've got a tax bill. This will be part of a budget package that will also include some pretty serious and controversial cuts. And all this has to happen bang, 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 bang. They also have to pass appropriations bills. They've got a debt limit increase. It's a really tough agenda, and they can't afford to lose any Republicans on any of it and have any kind of prayer of victory. So, I'm just continue to be astonished at disarray between the two ends of Pennsylvania Avenue when it comes to big things that everybody campaigned on. You'd think they just got around to thinking about it yesterday.
Well, Ed Kilgore, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
No problem.
And again, I've been speaking with Ed Kilgore, as a political columnist for New York Magazine and the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and his latest article at New York Magazine is Sessions Executes Strategic Retreat into Recusal but Leaves Some Big Questions Unanswered. We can take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with John Nichols about his article at The Nation, If Jeff Sessions Will Not Resign, He Should Be Impeached. Tell me, who's that? Who's that? Tell the truth. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor for the Capital Times, a daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and the author with Robert McChesney of It's the Media, Stupid, Tragedy, and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. His latest book is People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
It's great to be with you, my friend.
Well, thank you, John. And what do you make of today's activities? I mean, you have to admit that the New York Times and the Washington Post are doing a good job. I mean, they're staying on the case, and every day you read the newspaper, and it's pretty alarming. And I imagine if you're sitting in the Oval Office, it's even more alarming.
Well, so what you're saying up front is an important thing, that Donald Trump's great contribution to the American experiment may be the revitalization of, if not print, at least print and digital journalism. And let's give him his due. We have for a long time had a lot of concern about the decline of the press. And I think even during the campaign had that concern. But you are right. We are getting some serious revelations. And I think one of the reasons that we are getting these serious revelations relates to most journalism exposés and most of what we call investigative journalism, and that is leaks. You have people who are coming forward pointing reporters in particular directions. That's always been the case. That's where you, whether we like it or not, that's where we get our best material. And I think that President Trump and the people around him have, by their statements and by their actions, caused a sufficient number of people who are at or near their inner circle to feel it's necessary to drop a dime on them, so to speak. This is unlikely to stop. I expect it will continue. And in fact, interestingly enough, if we look at the revelations of this day, and I know we'll go more deeply into some of the specifics, if we look at the revelations of this day, they have been exponential. Last night, we learned things about Jeff Sessions. As this day has gone on, we have learned dramatically more about Sessions and his interactions with the Russian ambassador. But we have also learned all sorts of things about other people in the administration. It seems like, you know, every few minutes we're getting another, well, maybe you ought to be looking at that, or are you aware of this? And the end result is there's now no question that there will be, I think, a pretty serious congressional inquiry, nor is there much question that there will be some kind of Department of Justice inquiry that potentially could go quite deep. And finally, that Jeff Sessions will not be a part of that inquiry because he has been forced to recuse himself under a tremendous cloud.
Well, you have written an article at The Nation, if Jeff Sessions will not resign, he should be impeached. So that's a pretty tough headline.
Yeah, it is, but there's not much complexity to it. This is very simple. Jeff Sessions is the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. People often misinterpret the role of attorney general. They think that it's, you know, the attorney for the president. No, the president has White House counsel. They think that it's some sort of, you know, judicial sort of role. No, it's not that. The job of the Attorney General is to enforce the laws of the United States. Even elementary school children know that it is illegal to lie under oath. The reason you're given an oath is to make it very, very clear that you're in a circumstance where you're not supposed to lie.
How many times have we seen that in courtroom dramas? I remind you, the witness, <Yes. laughs> that you're under oath.
No, you're exactly, Ian, thank you for doing that, because that's exactly right. We need to clarify this circumstance. We now have evidence that Jeff Sessions lied under oath and that he lied in filling out a questionnaire, which certainly carries the imprimatur of a requirement of truth-telling. He lied to the United States Senate. Now, we are faced with his defenses. Of course, they have to be put forward. His first defense seems to be an absolutely absurd one, one that is beyond comprehension, and that is that he did not remember his own interactions with the ambassador of Russia. Two of these interactions, by the way, one on the periphery of the Republican National Convention, another one in his office, or apparently in his office. That no one who knows Jeff Sessions takes that very seriously. This guy's he's whip smart. He's very, very engaged. He's aware of everything that's going on around him, and he is, by many, many indications, somebody with a pretty encyclopedic memory. So that's an incredible claim. But then his second claim is an even more fascinating and frankly more unacceptable one. And that is that he wore two hats, and that when he went to talk to someone, sometimes he would talk to them as Donald Trump's, chief congressional counselor, earliest senatorial endorser, surrogate, aide, ally, comrade. And other times he was a U.S. senator, and that never the twain would meet.
But wasn't he also the head of Donald Trump's national security team?
Yeah,
and he brought and his deputy Miller is now a senior White House aide.
Yes, and of course Sessions who dined with Steve Bannon as far back as 2014, who was very very close to the Breitbart folks and to Bannon, and. So, yeah, this is a guy who's interwoven with all this, but he's claiming these are separate types. Okay, now, if you were to accept that argument, if you were to say, oh, well, I understand, sometimes you're a senator, sometimes you're a, completely interwoven surrogate, ally, connected person with the Trump campaign, that still falls apart because we've learned now that the first interaction with the Russian ambassador took place, as they say, on the sidelines of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. So the Russian ambassador traveled to Cleveland to associate himself with the process of nominating Donald Trump. Many international people do. That's not, that's not uncommon. The Republican convention this year was full of international representatives. I interviewed some of them. But he was there. And what did Jeff Sessions do at the Republican National Convention? He wasn't just, a senator passing through. He nominated Donald Trump for president. It is beyond comprehension that he could be interacting with someone at the Republican National Convention and have no tie to, no connection to the Trump campaign. It is simply not possible.
And of course, we had an impeachment of Bill Clinton, which didn't work. So because it has to come out of the Congress makes the case, and the Senate hears the case. That's the procedure. Both are in the hands of Republicans. If you just go forward to the possibility of impeachment, what's your sense of whether they're going to be serious about it? Because obviously they blew it last time, and I imagine that's sort of somewhat in their memory.
Yeah, but that's not their right. I'm sorry. I understand that members of our Congress are often partisans and ideologues. They're often strikingly inept people with very limited understanding of the Constitution of the United States. But the fact of the matter is the impeachment power was outlined for circumstances just like this, when the chief law enforcement officer of the United States is found to have been lying to the congressional body, the Senate, which is given the power to determine via the confirmation process whether that individual will serve as attorney general, and it turns out that he lied in his confirmation process. I mean, I'm sorry, you could not outline a clearer circumstance. Now, remember, impeachment is not a legal procedure. Impeachment is a political procedure, and I understand, certainly not naive about the politics of Washington, not naive about how it works. We do recognize partisanship, ideology. But what I'm saying is that we have reached a point where you can't take impeachment off the table. You can't say, this is just different, or it's new administration, or the Republicans control the House. That's silly. The fact is, Jeff Sessions faces demands now from the leader of the Democrats in the U.S. Senate, from the leader of Democrats in the U.S. House, from, I think, more than 100 House members, and certainly from the Congressional Progressive Caucus. This call for his resignation, which is very different than a call for recusal, this is real enough that it has to be considered. If he refuses, then at the very least, the suggestion of an impeachment inquiry, the raising of this issue, becomes necessary. Because, Ian, how else do you hold this guy to account? I mean, I realize that an impeachment inquiry might be blocked. I realize that people might say no, but that shame is on them. It's not. It shouldn't be that the process is so dysfunctional that nobody even tries and nobody even raises the issue. And I I'm not naive. I'm not suggesting that this is going to happen. But what I am suggesting is that you can't avoid it. You can't avoid the discussion, and you shouldn't, because if Jeff Sessions is able to, by all indications, lie twice to the United States Senate, and then say, I'm going to recuse myself from inquiries into an issue regarding the Russian ambassador, that doesn't absolve him. Recusal doesn't absolve him. If you lied to the Senate, you lied to the Senate. That is, by definition, an impeachable offense.
Well, obviously, the recusal is an attempt to put an end to this thing. But I take it you think that there's no way this is going to end, right?
No. I mean, look, I will tell you this, Ian. There's going to be people talking about this thing a long time to come. You know what I mean? It's no matter what happens. I mean, we are talking now about the Constitution, about constitutional remedies. This is a legitimate discussion that ought to be had. We ought to be comfortable with it. We fetishize accountability too frequently in this country and make it seem like something that is incredibly difficult or only to be used in the most extreme moments. No, I mean, you hold these people to account when they do the wrong thing. That's simple. But on the assumption that our system is not up to accountability moments, that it will not rise to that occasion, I think that's a fair assumption, then I can tell you that this is going to be constant. There are going to be steady revelations, and there are going to be people, Ian, who will establish in their own minds, based on the evidence that they have seen, that this attorney general is not legitimate, that he obtained his office via a lie, that he now attempts to cover for himself. And, I would suggest that if, just on the revelations of today and the logical consequences, that if you were tomorrow to go out and poll the American people, I think you'd have an incredibly significant number of them that would say he needs to be removed from office.
Well, given that this question that was asked by Senator Al Franken, in the confirmation hearings of Jeff Sessions. Do you think that Franken knew anything about the Russian connections? Because we've learned from the New York Times that the Obama administration, who, by the way, did not speak up sufficiently about what was happening during the elections about Russian interference, they knew about it and they kept quiet. Apparently, Secretary of State Kerry knew about it and was lobbying heavily for the White House to speak up. I recently heard from him that Hillary Clinton herself is mad as hell that neither Podesta or Jake Sullivan told her about the full extent of the Russian involvement. And so she's angry because she feels that she would have, had she known, she would have made an issue out of it. So what do you think's going on there? Do you think that somehow Al Franken knew something to ask that question?
Well, if you go back and look at the tape, and I recommend that people do, because this discussion is a very lively one at this point, there actually were news reports that day that influenced at least some of Franken's questioning. I'm not going to get into his head and try and say what he knew or what he didn't know, but what I would say is that there's some evidence that Al Franken is really one of the ablest people we've had in the Senate for a long time, that he gets information, processes it quickly, and turns it around even in a very tight time frame to ask tough and appropriate questions. That looks like what happened there. So there were things happening, you know, even the day of that session, which caused him to turn to questions about Russia. Now, does he know more? Well, one thing I can tell you is this. In interviewing members of Congress, a lot of them have in fact made the time to go and look at the intelligence reports and the information that is available to them. Many of them are on committees that allow them to have a high level of access to that information. And it is available, not to every member, not the same amounts of information to every member, but certainly a significant amount. So I would suggest that any serious member of Congress at this point has, or at the point of Sessions' confirmation hearing, had a reasonable level of insight and information regarding some of these issues. Now, Ian, I want to caution on one thing. We've got a lot going on here, and there's a lot of discussion about Russian involvement. And I don't know the extent of it. We hear a lot. We're hearing more. But remember, what we're talking about with Jeff Sessions here is not a question of did he meet with the Russian ambassador. He can do that. It's not a question of whether he met in his capacity as a senator versus his capacity as a Trump surrogate. It's not a question of what they discussed. Those are all issues of consequence and worthy of you know, examination and inquiry. What's at issue here is that when he was asked directly about it by the senior member of the committee, Senator Leahy, in a questionnaire, he said no. And when he was asked in another form by Senator Franken, he didn't just answer Franken's question, which was a much broader question. He specifically brought himself up. And he brought himself up as a Trump surrogate. You know, this is the issue. It's the question of, can this guy be trusted to tell Congress the full truth? Or is he going to engage in either what were at best attempts in a legalistic manner to avoid answering a clear question, and at worst, overt lies? So we've got two tracks we're talking about here. One, this broader question of Russian involvement and the concerns about that. But secondly, this question of an attorney general who appears to have a problem telling the truth when he's under oath and when he is in a situation where clearly he should be examined. And I don't want to belabor every element of this. The hearing before the Judiciary Committee took place at a point when Michael Flynn was still in as the security advisor. Flynn had to step down. Do you recall that, Ian? Did you notice when that happened?
Well, of course.
Yeah. Well, I would think that just about everybody did.
Right.
But that was before Sessions was approved.
Right. He stayed in there, actually, for Betsy DeVos's vote, didn't he?
Right. So couldn't... Now, here's the issue. If you got this huge scandal developing around meetings with the Russians, wouldn't that be the point at which you would, as Jeff Sessions, say, look, I'm sorry, Senator Grassley, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I want to update my testimony. Mm-hmm. You know, I've recognized that I might have confused people, or I believe I met in my official capacity as a senator. I don't think there's anything wrong here, but I want to put everything on the table so there isn't some incident or, you know, some revelation, you know, a few weeks down the line on the front page of the Washington Post that I had two meetings with the Russian ambassador, or two conversations that I didn't reveal when I was asked pretty direct questions about it. You know what I mean? He could have cleaned a lot of this up, but he didn't.
Well, John Nichols, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure, my friend.
And again, I've been speaking with John Nichols, who's the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent, and he is the author with Robert McChesney of It's the Media, Stupid, Tragedy, and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. And his latest book, or their latest book, is People Get Ready, the Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. And he has an article at The Nation, If Jeff Sessions Will Not Resign, He Should Be Impeached. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the failure of the Democratic Party to offer an effective response to Donald Trump's addressed to Congress. You can't hide your lying eyes, and your smile's a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize there ain't no way to hide your lying eyes. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us is Robert Dreyfuss, who's an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, Iran, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. And he recently co-founded ThePopulist.Buzz, a new online news platform devoted to reporting on and analyzing post-2016 efforts to rethink and rebuild the Democratic Party. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Dreyfuss.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
And I guess one of the questions that we have about the future of the Democratic Party in the Trump era came to light just the other night with the State of the Union address by Donald Trump, which the press is still quelling over and giving him such high marks for not saying something dreadful and being presidential. But in contrast to Trump's successful performance, the Democratic performance was widely panned, and a lot of people were scratching their heads as to why a former governor of Kentucky was in a diner in a strange setting, in a sort of deer-in-the-headlights situation, with a skinhead behind him. And the whole thing seemed so wrong and so wrong-footed. I guess my question to you would be, was that Donna Brazile's last decision at the DNC, or was it Tom Perez's first decision?
You know, I don't really know who made the decision. My guess is these things are done by committee. But whatever they thought they were doing, I think it was a huge failure. People who watched Trump's speech or who've been watching the administration as it came together in December and January. The Democrats, the independents, a lot of, you know, independent thinking people are ready to roll up their sleeves and fight. And watching Governor Beshear talk about the stuff that he said, which was, you know, soporific, to say the least. He didn't have any fight in him. I contrasted it in a piece that I wrote for the Populist.buzz with Bernie Sanders' response. The ironic thing about it was Sanders laid out 5, 6, 7 things that he indicted Trump for not talking about. He didn't talk about this. He didn't talk about that. Medicare, Social Security, single-payer health care, climate change, shrinking the Pentagon budget. Except every single point that he made, he could have said about the Kentucky governor, because he didn't mention any of those things either. And I just found, I put myself in the place, I guess, of a Democrat sitting in, you know, Cleveland or St. Louis or Philadelphia, watching Trump and then turning to the Democrats saying, oh, I want to see what the Democrats are going to say, and then being disappointed. And that's a problem with the party. It's a problem with their focus. And unfortunately, it may continue to the extent that the establishment in the party, which is not going to go away, the Clinton and Obama establishment, you know, now they've elected, as you mentioned, Tom Perez, the former Secretary of Labor. He's not a bad guy, but he owes his spot to those same establishment people. And they rejected Keith Ellison, who was the proposed candidate to lead the Democrats from the Bernie Sanders camp. So they're making bad decisions. And if the Democrats are going to be able to fight Trump on all of the fronts that are being opened one after another, you know, environment, health care, I mean, you just go down the list, they have to become a fighting party. And that's really what the Populist.buzz is about. It's aimed at the battle inside the Democratic Party and reporting not only on that, but the energy in the streets, because, you know, that's something pretty exciting, what's happening out there in the real world.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Dreyfuss, an investigative journalist who's written extensively on Iraq, Iran, the war on terrorism and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and The American Prospect. He's recently co-founded the Populist.buzz, a new online news platform devoted to reporting on and analyzing post-2016 efforts to rethink and rebuild the Democratic Party. So It's as though, you know, the Democrats have had two sort of wake-up calls here, and I'm not sure that they've noticed or taken heed. The first one was Bernie Sanders' campaign itself. It brought out all kinds of people, with very enthusiastic, big, big rallies, breaking all kinds of records, and in much outstripping Trump's much-touted rallies. This whole sort of generation of young activists are very hard to find in politics, and they've always castigated the young for not voting. But Bernie bought them out, and it doesn't look like the Democratic Party has really figured out a way to keep them in the tent. And all the DNC ever does is ask you for money. And these young kids don't have money, but they got energy and ideas, and they should be listened to, and they should be given directions. Well, guess what? They're doing it on their own. They're out demonstrating everywhere. I did a forum at UCLA last night on the Hammer Museum on the Standing Rock, and there was like 40 or 50 of these young kids in the audience who'd been to Standing Rock. You know, they put their lives on the line. It's happening,
you know,
out there.
That's the way it ought to be. I don't think change is going to come from the top down. It would have been good if Keith Ellison got the job. But the change is going to come from the bottom up. And if you look at what's happening around the country, I mean, look at in places like Kansas and Nebraska, there's change happening, right? In Kansas, they just elected several members to the DNC who were part of the Bernie Sanders camp, the young folks that you're talking about, who are now brand new DNC members. In Nebraska, of all places, the new chairman of the state Democratic Party is a young, fiery woman who was a leader of the Keystone XL pipeline protest. She's a grassroots organizer, and she's now running the Democratic Party in Nebraska. And in places like Hawaii and California and Washington State and elsewhere, one by one, the insurgent folks are taking over the state and the county parties and the organizations at the bottom and then going up to the state level. And I think that's the path ahead. It isn't that the politicians are going to lead this, you know, revolution or whatever you want to call it. It's they're going to follow. And, you know, we saw that. Remember the immigration protests at all the airports across the country? They emerged spontaneously out of Facebook and other social media. And politicians all over the country were scrambling to get out to the airports to give speeches to try to, you know, get ahead of this movement that was developing. Where I live in New Jersey, just in New Jersey, there are dozens and dozens of groups forming, women's groups, immigration groups, I mean, all kind of healthcare groups, protesting, doing town hall meetings. You know, this is something that's happening nationwide, and it's not being organized by the Democrats, but it could very well have a big impact on the elections in 2018. Which are really, really important for a number of reasons. A whole bunch of Republican governors are up. That's key for redistricting, going ahead to the 2020 and beyond elections where they redraw the lines for congressional districts. I mean, there's a lot at stake. A lot of things can happen. And you know, the one thing we can thank Trump for, a monster that he is that he's energized a lot of people.
Well, he's turned around the print business, hasn't he? Everybody thought the print, New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal were all going to go out of business. And boy, has he turned them around.
Well, I think that the Times and the Post have to hire extra people just to answer the phone when government officials call them up to leak stuff. Because there's also another line of resistance to Trump, which is inside the federal government, and not just the intelligence agencies, but the people who leaked, you know, a whole bunch of those early executive orders that then got trashed, the people who leak. I mean, all this stuff that's happening is because people inside the government, mostly, I would imagine, mid to lower level people who have access to stuff, are blabbing because they know that, you know, Trump is a menace. And so the media is partly invigorated by the fact that Trump is calling them names and they want to fight back, and partly from the, you know, it's like picking fish out of a barrel or something, you know. I mean, there's so much leaks to collect. And that's despite the fact that the cable news media is, you know, kind of shameless in its, I don't know, its blowing hot and cold on Trump, and I'm not talking about Fox, which is cheerleaders, but some of the other media goes off the deep end. I personally stay away from cable news, and right. I try to read newspapers and serious, you know, journals that whether I'm looking for facts or opinion that aren't just, you know, out for the highest ratings or whatever.
Sure. Well, Robert, just in the last couple of minutes, I want you to talk about the populist bars and what you plan to do and how people can get involved.
Well, it's a new URL ending, like .com. It's just .buzz. So it's thepopulist.buzz, like all one word. It's been up only a little over a week or so, maybe 10 days or so now. We have two authors, myself and Max Sawicki, who's an economist in Washington. We solicit pieces from other people. We try to report on what's happening inside the Democratic Party and among the the protest movement and the energy that's, you know, out there kind of asking for the Democrats to show some backbone. We've published a couple of investigative pieces, including a long one about the state of New Jersey, where there's an important Democratic primary going on. People can find all that stuff at our website, thepopulist.buzz. We also have a Facebook page and a Twitter account. We're just kind of launching. We're recruiting people to write for us, and we're getting some pretty good, you know, exciting people to contribute. And we'll also act as kind of a news service where we publish pieces and distribute them to, you know, other websites, whether it's Common Dreams or Alternet or Truth Out or, you know, all those. And then some of the magazines as well, the ones that you mentioned that I've been writing for, whether it's The Nation or The New Republic, we'll try to co-publish pieces with them. And eventually, once we get going, we'll start paying some reporters too. So I urge your listeners to check it out. It's thepopulist.buzz, B-U-Z-Z. And part of what we're trying to do is reclaim the idea of populism, that Trump is not a populist. I mean, you don't call yourself a populist if you populate your entire administration with people from Goldman Sachs and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's not what a populist does. But that seems to be what Trump is doing. And in fact, there's a good, healthy notion of populism, which is responsiveness to the concerns of real human beings out there, people who, whether they're working class or middle class or poor, who have political concerns and you know, want politicians to be responsive to them. So, yeah, thank you. It's thepopulist.buzz, and we hope that, you know, people will start checking it out.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Dreyfus.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Dreyfus, who's an investigative journalist who's written extensively on Iraq, Iran, the war on terrorism and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and is a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, and he recently co-founded ThePopulist.buzz, an online news platform devoted to reporting on and analyzing post-2016 efforts to rethink and rebuild the Democratic Party. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, scroll down the right-hand side, sign up for iTunes podcasts, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.